Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I don't know what to say, really. 3 minutes till the biggest battle of our professional lives all comes down to today. Either we heal as a team or we're gonna crumble. Inch by inch, play by play, till we're finished.
Welcome to Right Lane, a podcast of the Tampa Bay Times. Each week, Times reporter Lane DeGregory discusses her stories and answers your questions. The focus is on craft. My name is Maria Carrillo, and I'm the enterprise editor at the Times. Last week on the podcast, we had a conversation with Dick Weiss, an old friend from his days as an editor and writing coach at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Dick talked about a project he's working on called Before Ferguson, Beyond Ferguson. And while we had Dick in town, we also wanted to pick his brain for another podcast. So today's topic, coaching writers. All right, so talk a little bit about your favorite experiences with reporters and just reporters in general, how much you love them.
Well, maybe we should talk about, for people who come into this business a little later than us, and writing coaches
have gone away. Newsrooms used to have them. There was this great, person
they
sitting in
gurus.
The room, the guru, yeah, and right. You would go over there and they'd share their wisdom. And
I like to think of myself as an eminence.
Oh, yes. The eminent Dick
right.
Weiss.
Yeah. But let me back up just a little bit and kind of tell you how I ended up being a writing coach, because it's rather strange in that, A, I did not go to journalism school. So I was not trained as a journalist, and I was lucky enough going back to when you two were just a twinkle in your parents' eyes. 1973, I managed to get a job at the St. Louis or at the Kansas City Star, because they needed somebody to start right away, and they were hiring people at that point when the country was coming out of a recession, and I got paid $150 a week. And I didn't know a thing about really how to write a story, except that, my daddy was a television news producer, so they thought there might be something in the bloodlines. I mean, that's how desperate they were. Now, you can't get a job anymore without having gotten some training and been an intern and, paid your dues. I started the Kansas City Star, major metro market. And so one of my first stories was, there's a shooting down the street. Dick, go cover it. And so I had, I'm all excited. This is going to be like my first byline. And I go out there and I ask all the questions that I had learned by watching cop shows. And it didn't occur to me that maybe I should get the first name of the victim or what hospital the victim was sent to. And so I get back and realize I probably don't have enough material, nor do I know how to write it. So I call up to the morgue. That's what we used to call what?
The library, yeah.
The library. Yeah. And I say, please send me down the last 10 stories that have been done on shootings. And I look at this story and I say, oh, yes, I have not gotten the stuff that I need. So I'm scrambling and I'm writing it and so on.
You were a great hire. Yeah.
and then the editor, Kansas City Star, I'm not sure this is true. Maybe it's true here still at the Tampa Bay Times. The editors were paternalistic. They took care of you. They nurtured you. You don't need to answer that question. It's rhetorical, but
nobody's got time for that anymore.
they helped me figure it out, and they were very patient with me. And then I, ended up at the Post-Dispatch, and I had no idea how to write anything, but I was, if I can brag on myself, I was kind of clever. And they would put me on the do the funny stories, do the funny stories. And I would reinvent the wheel every time. And I'd sit there staring at my typewriter, not knowing how to write a story. Well, eventually I began to study the story forms. And let's just say they're 10, okay? You know, there's the news analysis piece, and there's the hard news, and then there's the anecdotal lead. And I didn't get to narrative till I was like 40 years old. But being self-taught, I think helped make me a better coach, in the sense that I could work with people who were totally clueless and understand why they didn't get something and explain it to them in a way that wasn't so classical or have this expectation that you should know this stuff and get impatient with them. And so that's, you know, and then getting to your question, which I do remember, even though I'm rather old now, what are my favorite experiences? Well, I used to be the kind of guy I got a reputation where you could turn in a messy story and I would fix it. And my editors loved the fact that I could just fix a story. Give it to Dick. You remember that cereal commercial? Give it to Joey, the cereal. Give it to Joey. He'll eat anything.
Mikey.
Yes.
Mikey.
Yeah, okay, we're aging ourselves. Most of our listeners cannot relate to that cultural moment, but it was a big thing. And I could fix it. And, of course, that wasn't doing those reporters any good, really. And at some point, I got a reputation like, if you wanted to own your story, which just about every journalist wants to do, please don't send my story to Dick. He'll weissicize it. I think that was a phrase people used. So that was not a good reputation to have. Eventually, I got to a place where I was beginning to learn how to teach writers stuff. And then they began to like coming to me. And the big thing, I think, was that reporters have the experience when they take an idea to an editor. The editor, often the first question an editor will ask is, well, how long do you need? And then they're thinking, well, how much is it going to cost? And they're asking all these questions that have nothing to do with the story, the essence of the story, or why the reporter is excited about the story. And so the question you should really ask is, why are you excited about the story? And the next thing that a lot of editors forget is, when an editor comes to you with an idea, it's much better to help them make it bigger than smaller. Bigger doesn't necessarily mean more time, but more ambitious. And that's where you guys, Lane and Maria, you are so good at making stories bigger, more important. And to help a reporter think through that is great. And then you also learn that as an editor, don't be the expert. Don't tell people what to do. Ask them questions and draw them out, because they're closer to the idea than you are. And so one guy, I almost got fired for this story. One guy comes to me with a story about the X Prize. I don't know if you guys remember that, but it was about 15 years ago. They're still doing these competitions. The first person who could send a private spacecraft into space, break, you know, zero, get to zero gravity and bring it down safely to a landing, would get $10 million. And this whole plan was hatched in St. Louis. And every year the editor would ask for what projects should we do this year? Do you have this an annual thing? Like, everybody submits their ideas to the top editor, and the top editor helps, you know, figure out how they want to allocate the resources.
We have like annual festivals, like the Gasparilla thing, that every year it's kind of like, what are we going to do for that?
Yeah,
you got to cover
it
again and again. Like your tuba thing, I remember you talking
about, right? Yes, the tuba festival. Yeah, I almost got fired for that one too. So we thought this was a great idea. Eli Kintish is his name. I'll never forget his name. It's a great name. And we submitted it, and the editor turned it down. Couldn't believe it. Just turned it down flat. And I said to my boss, Kathy, I said, do you mind if I take another crack at it. And so I created a whole PowerPoint presentation with I made the rockets. I spent hours on this. I made the rockets lift off. Animated them. I learned how to do kind of an animation where the rocket would lift off, and it was the rocket was taking the essentially the Post-Dispatch to fame and fortune, and so I did that presentation, and they finally sort of grudgingly let me do it. I thought they were grudgingly letting me do it, but actually I got ahead of myself and I started getting the photographers all riled up and interested in it. And my editor called me in. I said, "We didn't give you permission to do that." But by this time, you know, it was too far gone for her to pull it back. So Eli went out and reported the story. And, of course, it took longer than we said it would and so on and so forth. But it was a five-part series, and it won a prize, a space prize, for which Eli got $1,000 in cash, and he bought me a beer.
That's about right. I want to go back to that point about, like, so I think the best writing coaches and probably the best editors I've ever worked with, yeah, you know, you head their way, and you're thinking that you're looking for answers, and instead they ask you questions. And yes. It's a really good technique for those of you who are editors or want to be editors that don't jump right away. Just sort of try to understand whatever it is, whatever the story idea is, whatever the problem is, and then having people talk through what challenge they've got going on. It really helps them, but it helps you, right?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, a lot of your listeners may be line editors who have a lot of the day-to-day stuff, and they may not always be able to do a project or coach somebody through a project, but it just... Think about when you get a lead that comes in and it's really problematic, and your first instinct is to, like, touch the keyboard and fix it and do whatever it is you do. And I tell people to stop, read that paragraph, and figure out in your own mind, what is that reporter trying to say? And usually you can figure it out if you pause for a moment, because a lot of times you just make up your mind what the story is, just because you're an editor and you're smart, you know, and you figure that out. And then what I have done, what I've learned to do, is also, instead, even when I've figured out what that reporter is trying to say, I still don't fix it. I might, on my separate keyboard or separate screen, actually rewrite the lead so that I can understand it. But I will not put that lead in there. I'll go to the reporter, and I will talk to the person and say, "If I'm understanding this correctly, what this story is about is A, B, and C," and they will either agree or disagree. But if I've come pretty close, I will ask questions that may lead that reporter toward the paragraph that I have written quietly, secretly. But what often happens is that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This dialectic, use an SAT word, ACT word, this dialectic, this clash of ideas between the reporter and the editor, you come up with something better than you would have started.
And I always, I mean, Maria does this in spades, but I've always asked other editors, like, please just read it first without a pen. Mm-hmm. Don't start editing when you're in my copy the very first time, because sometimes the reporter has the point or the nut graph or the answer, and it's buried way down in the top, you know, below the anecdotal lead or whatever. So I love editors. They'll just read it first as a reader and then come back in and start fixing.
You have to recognize that it is so hard for editors not to touch the keyboard. It is so hard when they see just one little flaw to start fixing. It is so. Just give them a little pat on the back when they don't do that, and they read it all the way through.
And I'm sure you came to this too, Deck. But I mean, like, over the years, I felt like The longer I go, the more I believe that editing is not what I do with my hands.
Right.
Right? No,
right.
Seriously. Yes. You know, that you get away from the keyboard and it really is a conversation. And it's like, I feel like most of my heavy lifting as an editor, like say with Lane, is in our conversations, is in our, you know, what do you have and how are we going to frame it and where are we going with it? When we get to the point that there's actually copy on a screen, it's us polishing it. It's us sort of trying to smooth it out or, you know, this, you know, take another stab at this because I think you can make it better or here's where I got tripped up. But then really, like, if you're spending all your time hacking away, yeah, you're not really helping.
Walt Harrington had a funny line. There are some writers that actually appreciate you just taking their story over and fixing it for them. And he had a great relationship with a guy who would introduce Walt and say, "This is Walt Harrington. He wrote some of my best stories." But I don't want to be that guy. I don't think Walt would either, generally speaking, because especially with the younger writers, you want to have them get better. And I am old enough now to have seen what has happened. I mean, I feel like a third grade teacher who's a 25-year-old comes back to them in a classroom and said, you know, I'm, you know, a vice president for this or that. And, you know, and she's remembering that person didn't know which end was up in third grade. And I've seen this happen, that this works, this just asking questions and just being a good mentor rather than a fixer is the way to go.
I think newsrooms today, too, like we've gotten away from a traditional writing coach in a corner, but I feel like everybody turns to everybody else who's still here. Like, you know, you go find somebody. It could be a reporter helping another reporter. You kind of make your own writing coaches, really, in those relationships.
That's absolutely true. And there's a whole lot. I mean, you can be not likely to happen much anymore. You could be named writing coach, but every reporter has a writing coach in the newsroom, and it is not necessarily the writing coach. It's the person at the next desk. It might not be the person that they report to as an editor. It might be a different editor. Nobody should get in the way of that. The one thing that I always tell people, just in terms of, you know, from the reporter's point of view, is read before you turn it in. Read it out loud. It will either sound conversational or comfortable, or it won't. And you'll catch a lot of typos that way as well. Share it with somebody, what we call a candid friend, somebody who likes you and wants to see you succeed, which is probably your spouse, or you hope it's your spouse, in many cases, and sleep on it. You think you're done, hopefully, you know, it's not necessarily a deadline thing that day. Go home, sleep on it, and come back and look at it fresh, and it'll be amazing what you can catch. The polishing is, 50% of the quality of the story comes in the last 5% of your time, I think.
That's all great advice. If you've been listening to this podcast for a year and you're not reading out loud, then we are really disappointed in you. Okay? That's really important. I assume, so you're still doing some coaching. You're still working with writers.
Yeah,
you're still
I actually still get some calls every so often from people at the Post-Dispatch because the newsroom is smaller and there's less people to go to and they got editors trying to do so many more things than we used to have to do. And so I hear from them, and so that makes me feel good, feel relevant. People in the community come to me, and I work with people. The thing that I love to do is I ghostwrite, essentially. So there are people who come to me, and they'll say, "Would you look at my material? I need help with it." And some places. What really makes me mad is I had a sculptor come to me and she had written a memoir and it was like all it needed was like a little light copy editing. I said, "That's not fair. I just devoted 40 years of my life to learning the craft and this person can put it together like that." I mean, there are just some geniuses out there. So she didn't need much help. And then there was a financial advisor, an evangelical financial advisor who wanted help with a book on how to invest your money in a godly kind of way. Okay, I'm Jewish. I don't know anything about money or math if I did know something.
Journalist, that, yeah.
Right. I always said that the way to job security in journalism is you're the guy in the newsroom who can do percentages because everybody will come to you. And so what was cool for me to do was he knew that I could write it for him, and I just had to learn about Jesus and to have
he was Jewish
and to have right and to have the voice of this man of an evangelical investment advisor. And so yeah, pulled that off. If you can do that, you can write about almost anything, right?
When we were trading thoughts about this episode, one of the things you mentioned was how much the one-on-one relationship is at the heart of coaching, right? So talk a little bit about that. I mean, that's away from a particular story. It's about building some bonds with people.
Right, right. You know, one of the reasons why people will come to me is there's a it's so transactional these days with editors. It's like, we got a story. What are you going to do? When are you going to have it? How long is it going to be? And then when you turn it in, they might rip it apart. You should take the time to have lunch with your reporters and to find out what their aspirations are, where they want to go, how they want to get from here to there. Some people want to be the next Lane to Gregory, and some people want to be something else. And so if you know what they want out of life, you know what their story is, essentially, their narrative, then you can, whatever it is that you're suggesting or advising, you can make that dovetail with where they want to go. And so they're a lot more susceptible to taking whatever advice you may be sharing with them. And, of course, we're doing this advice in a very sort of indirect way. So that's, yeah, know your reporters. Be friends with your reporters. Somebody's told me you should be your best reporter's best friend and your worst reporter's worst enemy. But I would focus on the best friend part because I think there's everybody's beset these days. It's really hard to be a journalist.
And you disarm them because they're not used to editors who actually care beyond the transactional, I think. You know, it's
you're just getting the story ready for the next
day. Right.
I mean, you understand the why that is because they're under a tremendous these editors are under a tremendous amount of pressure these days to get the stuff up. And now we didn't have the I left the Post-Dispatch 14 years ago. We didn't have the 24-hour news site. I mean, to get something up really fast, and I don't even know how your editing process works with your tweets and your, you know, all that stuff that you have to get out there. Does anybody even look at it before it gets out there? And I don't know what your systems are for that, your process. But so, you know, recognize the editor's under a lot of pressure, and the editors need training. The one thing that tell me about your experience, if we have a minute, Maria. When I was made an editor, my instructions were go sit at this desk up here, and when you're done with the story, send it to this desk. Okay? That was the entire training that I got. And remember, I hadn't been to journalism school. They just thought, oh, he's a pretty good writer, might make a good editor. Did you get any?
I was a reporter on a Friday. I was an editor on a Monday. And the only thing my boss said to me was, she turned to me and she said, you know, you can't be friends with those guys anymore. And these were some of my best friends in the world, you know, and I thought, well, that just sounds really kind of insane. Like, what, I'm supposed to stop talking to them now? Like, but, you know,
That
was
crazy.
It. That was the extent of my editing.
You know, it's
training.
Like, okay, Mr. Medical student, here's a scalpel and go do brain surgery. You know, there's got to be more training. And of course, this paper has created the Poynter Institute, right? Or is it the other way around?
We created them.
Yeah. And so if there's any place that should be able to get that, it would be this place.
It's still the way it is, I think, industry-wide, though. You know, you get a promotion, and people assume that the same skill sets translate, and it's just a different job. It's
Right.
You know.
And I got so much great training at Poynter. Forget about the wordsmithing. The managing people. When you're an editor, you are also a manager. And when I came up in this newsroom, there were a lot of decorated people. They'd won Pulitzer Prizes and so on and so forth. They had no idea how to manage people. And so I, again, I was self-taught on a lot of these things, and I was lucky enough that they had the money to send me a few pointer things. And then I would do these writer's workshops, and I'd sit in and I'd listen to how people did it. And writing for story, John Franklin's book. Okay, my first foray into narrative was I had a story and I had John Franklin's book, and I set it up on a stand like you do with a cookbook. And I said, oh, okay, now I'm to the point of insight. And I read how he did it, and then I went over to my story, and I kind of massaged it and did it that way. I'm sure it was clunky, but it was a start. And what the funny thing was, it was a little bit like you take the souffle out of the oven, and people go crazy over it. It was my first story that really got a big reaction because it was a narrative. It was a big beginning, a middle, and the end. We had no narrative in the Post-Dispatch, really, to any extent, except by accident, up to that point. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I got all these. I think by then there were emails. There wasn't anything that went viral, right. But it was like I got 10 times bigger response to writing this narrative. And I thought, I'm on to something.
All right. On that note, we're going to, if you have a question for Dick or for Lane, or you'd like to suggest a podcast topic, please email it to writelane@tampabay.com. That's WriteLane at tampabay.com. If you want to hire Dick, we can put you in touch with him. So just let us know. And join us next week on Wednesday morning for another podcast. This podcast was produced by Monica Herndon. Music was composed and performed by Dan DeGregory. Thanks for listening.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.